everybody. My name is Ross Selby, and I am a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting me out. It's been a wonderful ride and a beautiful day, and I will share a little bit of my story of what my drinking was like, and then what happened, and what it's like today. And today it is beautiful, I will tell you. Start with a little event that happened. My wife and I were driving down the road, and first off, there was a sheriff, and the sheriff pulled over the station wagon driving down the road. And when he walked up to the station wagon, and he's looking inside, looking at the gentleman inside, he noticed that the back of the station wagon was full of stuff. Cans of gasoline and torches and chainsaws, and you know, he was a little worried about it. And the driver says, "No, officer, no, don't concern yourself. I'm a juggler, and this is my material. Let me show you." So he hops out of the station wagon and he pulls some torches out and he dumps them in the gasoline and sticks them in the ground and lights them on fire. And he pulls out about three chainsaws and he starts them up and he grabs them up and he starts juggling, and he's juggling these chainsaws and these torches, and about that time the wife and I rode by, and I looked at her and said, "Jane, it sure is a good thing we quit drinking, because those roadside sobriety tests are getting harder and harder." I like to start with a little humor, because I tell you, when I walked in the door the first time, there was no humor in me. But we are not a glum lot. God has given me the ability to laugh at myself, and to really enjoy life. I call myself a recovered alcoholic because God has removed from me the compulsion to drink. And that's straight out of the big book. It's one of our promises, one of our many sets of promises in there. And all I had to do was go to a lot of meetings and work closely with a sponsor in the steps, and wait until God came to me and relieved me of that desire to drink, right? Now, by no means am I saying I'm cured. I will die an alcoholic. I will be buried an alcoholic. And I know that if I were to pour 1 ounce of alcohol in me, that insanity would snap right back. But the blessing is that I don't spend any time in my life worrying about not drinking. Right? That compulsion has been removed from me. And I share that because there is so much hope in that. I remember fairly early in my recovery, my sponsor sharing this passage with me, and this passage was so important that it gave me the hope that one day, with a little bit of work, I too could have this. This is out of Into Action, page 84 and 85 out of our big book. "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is a miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience, and that is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." Now, those are the 10th step promises. So, obviously, to get to them, I had to work steps 1 through 9 and continue to take care of my spiritual self. When I first heard that, it gave me a lot of hope that one day I too could cease fighting. I could stop avoiding temptation. I could live free, literally live free of alcohol. So let me rewind a little bit and tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened to get me to where I am today. In respect of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will talk about alcohol and drinking, but just know that my past is very checkered with many other substances that changed my mood and how I felt. Okay? So if those happen to impact you, when I say drinking, think of whatever it was that you chased after. Okay? So, and when I talk about God, and I will talk a lot about God, I mean God as you understand Him, right? I will talk about how God has impacted my life and the changes in my life and the blessings in my day-to-day life, right? But when I say God, don't think of Ross as God. Think of God as you understand Him. What a blessing it is that this program gave us that open door, right, so that each and every one of us could find God or a higher power as you understand Him. So where do I begin? I was born in a little town called Phoebus. It's part of Hampton. It's a lower end, considered maybe slummy. I was from a big family. I was the oldest boy, 4 older sisters and 2 younger brothers, right? And that should be against the law. 4 older sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, in my childhood, it was like having 5 mamas, and they were always pointing and telling me what to do and where to go. And very rarely did they point in the same direction and tell me the same instruction, right? But mom didn't work, dad did, and so there wasn't a lot of money in our household. I grew up poor. I would not have said that at the age of 10 because I didn't know, right? But by that time, I was starting to recognize it. There was a lot of love in our family. We did things together in groups. But most anything we did, most anywhere we went, there was drinking. Okay, and that's just how it was. Bowling alley, well, you know, the adults always had beer on the table. And we littler kids, right, off to the nursery or off to the pinball machine, right? But drinking was there. The VFW or the Elks Club or the other social events that happened in my parents' life, there was always drinking. So I was always interested in drinking. I always wanted to know about drinking. And I looked towards that point in my life where I, too, could drink, right? So from a very early age, it's like it's a rite of passage. I saw it with my older sisters, right? As they got older, then they were allowed a glass of wine or a beer. And I knew that one day it would be my turn. Like I say, a very loving family. We were close. We didn't have a whole lot. Needless to say, with 7 children, there were a lot of hand-me-downs. Being the oldest boy, really caught it when the hand-me-downs were coming from older sisters. Now, that's not to say that my parents dressed me in dresses or anything like that, but I never had the cool things that everybody else had, right? Or at least it seemed to me everybody else had. Butter cookies, right, were the $1.99 tennis shoes that my mom could afford. But when she's got 7 of us lined up to buy a school clothes, right, they had to take advantage of everything they could. I often felt less than, right? I often said, if I could dress like he dresses or if I had the cool shoes like they had, So I started very early in my life feeling like there was a level where I just wasn't worth it, right? I just didn't have everything that everybody else had. So I grew up with that less than attitude. My mama was one of 13 kids, so she was from a huge family, and we went back to my mama's hometown every year for a family reunion. And it was wonderful because most everybody would make it, and I could pile in with over 100 first cousins, right? And, you know, from every size, right up and down. And but even when I was around the most special people in my whole life, I didn't quite feel like I fit in. I'm the kid from Phoebus, right? I'm the one that's wearing patched blue jeans, or even worse, you know, we couldn't have Levi's, right? So we got those $4.99. It wasn't a Walmart at the time, but we got the $4.99 blue jeans. So I just never had any self-confidence. I never felt like I was good enough to fit in with the people that I was around. That carried into school, through elementary school, into junior high school. And that is about the time. I really waited a long time before I started my drinking career. You know, I made it all the way to the ripe old age of 13. And, you know, for those with math on their fingers, at seventh grade, I fell right in. Wasn't always drinking because alcohol wasn't always available, but there were other things that were a lot more available to a 13-year-old if I had a little bit of money. I had money. I had a job. I got my first job when I was 10, busting tables, washing dishes. And I worked my whole life. But once I found that miracle of that first drink, right? And it wasn't the first sip of the first drink, because I remember stealing a beer and drinking it and thinking, this is horrible, you know? My daddy drank Schlitz. And I remember thinking, this is horrible. Why does anybody do this? But within a very short period of time, a number of weeks, I achieved that first real buzz, that first moment where everything inside of me kind of drained out, and I was given that shield of alcohol, you know, that I'm taller than I was, right? I'm more handsome than I was. I'm better looking. I'm a better dancer and a better talker, right? And I could be around women and I could not feel so other than, right? Not feel so left out. Like I say, that started for me around the age of 13, and it jumped me straight onto the rat wheel of chasing a better buzz. And I spent the next 17 years of my life looking for the next better buzz. And I didn't drink, obviously, at the age of 13 every day. But I drank at every single chance that was available. Every single time that I could, right? I remember it hadn't been long, a couple months, and there was this wine sack full of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine, right? And the guys taught me, well, you take this wine sack and you turn it up and you squeeze it real hard and it would just squirt a jet of wine, which kind of tastes like Kool-Aid, straight down your throat. And it was wonderful, and it made me feel yah-yah, completely out of whack. And an hour later, I was over in the bushes, you know, puking in Technicolor. And yet it did not stop me. The very next chance I had to drink Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, I'm like, absolutely, let's go, let's do it. I drank a lot. Like I say, every chance that I could. Around the age of 15, I met this group of people that were quite a bit older than me. They were in their early 20s. And I started hanging out with them much more than I did people at school. Met my my girlfriend, who was to become my wife. And so at the age of 15, I'm dating a 20-year-old woman who is employed and has a car and a little bit of spending money. And so, you know, I'm feeling really awesome here. You know, I'm cool here, right? I'm not quite sure what she ever saw in me, 15-year-old, GPA of 0.0 for a couple of years in high school, right? I would go just enough to stay out of trouble, but I didn't apply myself at all. You know, I was always looking for something else, right? Who can we hook up with at lunchtime? Who can get us a 12-pack? Where can we go, right? And that's what I was constantly and continuously chasing. Around the age of, 10th grade, 11th grade, Darlene realized that, you know, graduating high school would be really important, right, for me. And so she convinced me, and I rolled up my sleeves, and I started to apply myself, right? So 11th grade summer school, 12th grade summer school. I was an AB honor roll student. And I share that because I believe that's a trait that runs through many of us, is that when we apply ourselves to something, we can truly excel, right? Most alcoholics I know are really smart, and I was really smart. And once I decided that I needed to do this, then I did it. Got a job. 6 months before I graduated, my son was born. Jason was born. I was 17 years old when he was born. And so needless to say, right out of high school, I got a job and started my first real work. I was grateful. I was fortunate that an electrician hired me. His name was Tiny Mallory. He ran a shop in Hampton, and my hair was about as long as it is now. Actually, it's a little bit longer. And so when I went in to meet Tiny Mallory, he took one look at me and says, "Okay, boy, if you show up on Monday with your hair cut above your collar, I'll give you a job." And so I knew that he was trying to shove me, give me a good hard shove, and see if I was serious. And I was. I cut it off. Showed up to work on Monday. I didn't know a wing nut from a wire nut, but they put me in a truck and took me out and started to teach me, right? Of course, he pulled me aside and says, "You need another haircut." I'd cut off a 24-inch ponytail, right? He says, "You need another haircut before payday because you won't get a pay envelope. It needs to be above your collar and above your ears." And I'm like, okay, I see where he's coming from. But he did me a wonderful thing because he gave me a job and gave me a chance and let me begin to learn a trade. Okay, so I got another haircut, worked hard, continued to do exactly what I was doing, chasing every minute I can. The mechanic they put me in had a habit of, when we'd leave the shop at 8 o'clock in the morning, we'd stop and get two tall boys on the way to our first job. And then on the way back in, two tall boys on the way back in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So fed right into exactly what I was doing, right? So I fell into it. I liked it. I liked it a lot. Began to make some real money for the first time in my life. And so that allowed me to buy more and different things and go to more expensive bars and drink these fancy label beers. But I was still chasing that buzz. It was the same old, same old. Didn't create a lot of problems in my life because the wife was doing it. You know, we were managing to take care of Jason. But, you know, this is just what we were doing. As the years progressed, you know, the repercussions got a little worse. You know, crash car, DUI, night in jail, right? Those things began to pile up, but that was okay because I had it all figured out. If only the boss and the wife and the judge would get off my back, right, and leave me alone, right, then things would be all right. Things got worse at home, a lot worse. My drinking escalated. I began to really abuse my wife, and I mean physically, verbally, emotionally, spiritually, across the board, period. And I was doing horrible things. I won't say I was a horrible person, because I am the person that I am, but I was doing horrible things. And so after I balled my fist up and hit her, that was the end of that marriage. And so I moved out at the age of 29 years old for the first time in my whole life. I'd never balanced a checkbook. I'd never done my own laundry. I'd never taken care of anything that would be considered responsible. And now the little bit of responsibility that I had hanging over me, being the wife and family, was gone. And I started to just absolutely run crazy. Run crazy. I was working. I was a hard worker when I showed up. And I would always volunteer to stay late because I knew that I could make some overtime and some extra money. But my drinking was impacting my work. I was on final written warning at work, right? I've been put out of the house, sleeping on mama's sofa. Many a great alcoholic got sober on their mama's sofa. Trust me. And my life was crumbling all around me. In hindsight, it's very easy for me to see that I was very depressed. I was very depressed. And the more depressed I was, the more I drank. And the more I drank, the more depressed I got. Because guess what? A lot of alcohol is a depressant. So in about 6 months' time, that spiral got so bad that I reached a point where I was going to kill myself. I could not see anything left in this life worth living for. I had run out of everything. Great alcoholic that I was. I'm home playing my stereo, crying your beer music, and I couldn't do it until I finished all the beer in the refrigerator, right? Because if I did, I mean, the beer wouldn't go bad, right? I didn't think about steaks in the freezer or laundry at the laundromat, right? I thought about the beer would go bad. And so I'm sitting there finishing off this beer, just crying, listening, playing that music, and the phone rang. Now, back in these days, we had these things called answering machines, right? And they had two little cassette tapes inside of them, right? And when somebody would call, it would play my message. You know, hey, this is Ross. Leave me a message, right? And then you could listen to the other person on the other line as they left a message. I didn't answer the phone, but I did click the mute button on the stereo, and it was my daughter, 5 years old at the time. And she's like, Daddy, I didn't need anything. I just called to say hi, and I hope you have a great night. Talk to you soon. And she hung up the phone. And no question in my mind, God reached out and poked me right square in the solar plexus and said, pay attention, boy. There's something in your life that you're not thinking about. I called 1-800 suicide hotline number out of the Yellow Pages, and I talked to this little angel for a couple of 3 hours, and she didn't fix me, right? And she didn't even promise me that if I didn't commit suicide that I would get better. But she promised me that my life would get different. right? If I was willing to do some things, that my life would get different. And that's what I wanted. I hated being where I was. I felt so worthless, lower than whale poop at the bottom of the sea, and I just couldn't see how anything could get any different. She convinced me to go to Norfolk Psychiatric Hospital, which I did. Got in my little car and drove over to Norfolk Psychiatric Hospital and told them, "My name's Ross. I'm suicidal." Right? And went through this interview process with this entrance counselor, right? And I expected them to put me in a little rubber room, you know, maybe a love yourself jacket, and, you know, and come to a couple days later. I say I come to, the fog lifted enough that I realized they had put me on the drug and alcohol ward, right? And I spent the rest of that day trying to convince my counselor that they had made a mistake, right? That a couple of dozen Budweisers a day just wasn't part of my problem, right? How could two dozen Budweisers create a problem like that, right? That poor woman, she followed me up and down this big long hall. There was, you know, hospital rooms on each side, and I gave her every reason why I couldn't stop drinking. I didn't want to stop drinking, right? I mean, what was I going to do for New Year's Eve if I couldn't drink? And she's like, "Ross, it's May 11th. I'm like, "Well, you know, 4th of July is coming up soon, right?" And I finally wore her down, and she threw her hands up, and she said, "Okay, F it." And that's not the word she used, but she said, "Go see the doctor, and he'll sign you out AMA. And that's what I did. I went and saw Dr. Mark, and you know, he says, "Come on in, Ross. Tell me, why can't you stay here a couple of days and give this program a chance?" Good alcoholic that I am, I had 27 excuses already queued up, right? I didn't have any clothes. I didn't have a toothbrush. I didn't have a razor, right? My mama doesn't know where I am, right? And so on and so on and so on. And finally he says, "There's something about you. I'm going to take a chance with you. We'll call it God divinity, okay? I'm going to take a chance with you that I've never done with anybody before, but 48 hours in here, I won't even say sober because the fog was still lifting at that point, I'm going to give you a 3-hour pass. I'm going to let you go home and get a suitcase and get some clothes if you will promise me that you won't drink and you won't do any drugs and you'll go straight, take care of your business, and come straight back again." And wow, that hit me hard. I don't know why, but it really hit me hard because here's a man that's offering me some trust. Here's a man that's extending something to me that nobody had trusted me in years. Nobody had trusted me in years, right? You know, I didn't talk about all the crazy things I'd done in my running days, stealing and lying and thieving and stepping out on a marriage, but I know you guys know what that part is all about. But here's a man that's going to trust me. So I got in my little car and I drove straight home and I got my bag and I called my mama and I put some things in that bag and I drove straight back again and I walked up to the counter and I handed the lady my slip. And she looked and says, "You got a 3-hour pass." I'm like, "Yeah." She says, "Well, you've only been gone for an hour. You got 2 more hours." I'm like, "No, Dr. Mark told me to come straight back." And so that's what I did. For once in my life, I don't know why, I do today. Because there was some divine guidance going on that was driving me, although I would not have called it that. I would not have claimed it at that moment in time. So I went back, and I stayed, and I remember talking to the doctor and calling my boss and saying, "I'm going to be here a few more days, and so on. And finally, after about the fourth call to him, he said, I'm going to be here for 17 more days. But he was good with it. I had been in trouble at work, and they tried to force me into drug and alcohol rehab about 3 years prior, and it didn't happen. I learned a lot at Norfolk Psychiatric. I learned an immense amount about the disease of alcoholism. It wasn't something that was wrong with Ross any more than I had a disease, right? We don't get angry if someone gets cancer, right? We feel for them. We're not upset with a person who gets diabetes, right? We try to help and support them, right? Well, drinking was not that in my vision, but I learned a lot about it. And I started to take a hard look at myself for the first time to face the man in the mirror, right? The folks at Norfolk Psychiatric did a good job helping me begin to work the steps as much as they could with their material, right? And they carried me to a lot of meetings. And they gave me a meeting schedule, right? And I'd show up on the white bus, and I'd be sliding the armband up under my shirt so nobody could tell, right? But they did a wonderful thing as I left at the 28-day mark. They brought me a tablet of paper, and they asked me to write a little contract to them. And so this blank sheet of paper, and I wrote on there, I, Ross M. Selby III, do promise. And they're telling me what to write. Number one, I will go to a lot of meetings. Number two, I will get a sponsor. Number three, right, I will not pick up a drink or a drug. Number four, I will pray. And then I sign my name to it. And they put that in my folder, and that's what they used to close out my medical folder at Norfolk Psychiatric Hospital. Now, why that contract was important to me, I don't know, but it was. It was so very important to me that even though I left on Friday and I tried to talk them into keeping me till Sunday, I went straight home, I dropped my bag, I called my mama, and I went to an AA meeting. And I rolled in there about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday afternoon, and we had a little meeting, and I introduced myself, and I said I was new. In fact, I might have got a 30-day chip. So as soon as the meeting was over, everybody invited me and says, well, why don't you hang out? It was a clubhouse. Why don't you hang out? We're going to play some cards. I'm like, okay. And so we dragged the tables together, and we played cards still. About 7:30, they start pushing the tables back. I'm like, what's wrong? Oh, we're going to have another meeting. And so we had another meeting, and we played some more cards. And lo and behold, by the grace of God, next thing I knew, midnight, and I'd made it through that day. That very first day, that danger zone, walking out of Norfolk Psychiatric, 29 days sober now. Fear drove me back to Alcoholics Anonymous almost continuously. Fear, right? And I'll be honest with you. I am not afraid of drinking, but I'm afraid of feeling like I felt when I wanted to take my own life. I'm afraid of going back into that hole in the soul place where I was so empty and so barren and so helpless and so hopeless and so worthless. That I'm afraid of. So I was working at a place where I ran a service truck, so I was on the road all the time. I found a lunchtime meeting I could make it to every day. I could fix my schedule, so I'm on that part of town. And I went to a lunchtime meeting every day. And then 5:30 or 7 o'clock or an 8 o'clock meeting every evening. And fear kept me going back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a great fear. It helped me so much. I got a sponsor right away. My sponsor, I was sitting in a meeting, and at a big long table, and he was an old man down at the end of the table. I mean, older than dirt, right? And woman had brought up the topic. You know, my boss is giving me a really hard time at work, right? He's always picking on me, and I just don't know how I'm going to handle this. And as the conversations was going around the table, you know, there were some cute and funny things. You know, one guy says, "Oh, Phyllis, every time your boss walks in your office, envision him standing there in women's panties and underwear, right?" And, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, this old guy down at the end of the table, he's getting red-faced, right? And so finally, when it got around to him, he slammed both fists down on the table and says, "Damn it, Phyllis, you know better. Nobody can make you feel anything unless you give them that power. Nobody can make you feel or do anything unless you give them that power." Well, that man seemed so mean that I asked him immediately to be my sponsor. I said, "This is what I need. Somebody that will not take excuses. Somebody that will not give me an easy time." Thank God for Bob. Bob put me directly into the steps. Jumped right into step one right away. It was pretty easy to see that my life was unmanageable. You know, people who manage their lives don't wind up with these big green hospital bands on their arms in a place where all the doors were incorrectly engineered because the handles were on the outside, right? I mean, but that was me, you know. Powerless over alcohol. Yes, I could say I was powerless over alcohol because in that short period of time, 30, 45 days, my life had begun to change. Right? There were some wonderful, wonderful changes that happened in the first 30, 60, 90 days. Right? I was making it to work 5 days a week. That's incredible. Dressed, showered, teeth brushed, clean uniform. Right? That was something that had not been happening in my life. I wasn't hungover in the morning. I didn't wake up feeling horrible, right? I hadn't thrown up, right? I hadn't spent a night in jail, right? And these may seem like little things, but to me, at that moment in time, they were huge things, right? So step one was not hard for me from where I came from, right? That desperation of suicidal had driven me to that point. Step two, I started the first meeting I went to, and I saw the 12 steps on the board, and I saw God, 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 God. I mean, nowhere did it say alcohol, right? Or nothing but the first step. I was going to have a hard time with that, right? But my sponsor made it real easy for me. I grew up in church. I learned about a damning God that was keeping track of my life. And at the end of my life, I'm going to stand in front of the pearly gates and I'm going to have to atone for everything that I had done. And either this God is going to be merciful and let me into heaven or he's going to send me to hell. Right. And there was no way I could ever balance the X marks that was in my book. I had a few check marks. I was a Boy Scout. I helped the little old ladies with the groceries, right? But boy, the X marks from my drinking and running times. Thank God for a great sponsor. He told me, and you're going to hear me say that a lot. He told me, "Ross, you don't have to use any kind of God that you know of." And it says, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, the door is wide open for you to understand your higher power as you understand him," right? He gave me some guidance. He said, "What if we said God was all caring? And what if we said God was all forgiving? And what if we said God was all loving, right? And what if we said God has already forgiven you for everything you've done in your whole life? And now we just need to help you forgive yourself." And I'm like, "Well, okay, I can do that, Bob. I can do that. That's easy, right?" So when I stood at that passage in the big book where it says either God is or God is not, either God is everything or he is not, it was easy for me to say God is everything because God got me into this program. Right, I was seeing rooms full of folks just like you, right, who had done something I could not do. Right, you had set down the booze, and not just because you had to, not because you were duct taped to a chair, but you had found a happy life without alcohol, And that's what I wanted. So when it came to the third step, and I looked at that third step prayer, and I realized that this was not just a simple decision, right? That this decision required a lot of action, right? That when I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him, right? That was only the beginning, right? And so the action that I had to take at that point was to seek out, what is God's will? What is God's will? If I'm going to live by God's will, how do I know what that is, right? Thank God for a great sponsor, right? He kept carrying me straight back to this book over and over. He kept showing me exactly what to do. He even taught me how to pray. He says, Ross, let's make it real simple, right? In the morning, in the evening when you get home from work, take off your work boots, push them as far up under the bed as you can. And while you're down there pushing them up, say, thank you, God, for allowing me to stay sober another day. Right? In the morning, when you're running around and can't find your boots and you remember they're under the bed and you get down on your knees to drag them out, simple prayer. God, help me stay sober today. Help me know your will for me today. Right? And I needed that. I needed that. I grew up thinking, you know, prayers were, God, you should do this, and God, you should do that, and heal my Nana, and, you know, get me a shinier bike, and you know, if I had a prettier wife or a nicer house or a better neighborhood, right, or if I could get that promotion, right, everything would be wonderful. But he told me, no, we're going to take this and we're going to turn it upside down. And in every situation, the prayers will be, God, what is your will for me in this situation? Right. And that really turned it around for me, began to change my life. I began to have a little bit of faith, tool that he gave me. And I love it. I give it to my sponsees all the time. Somebody will call me and say, oh, you wouldn't believe what happened. I was here. I was there. I was at Walmart. And guess who came around the corner? And man, we talked for 45 minutes about recovery and alcoholism and things like that. You know, and the little tool is, when these odd things happen in my life, I ask myself, was that odd or was that God? And I realize that these coincidences don't just happen, right? That it wasn't just a coincidence that my daughter called me on that day, on that night, that I needed to hear her voice and get out of that funk I was in, right? And God has been running the show all my life. He never closed the door on Ross. It was me that pushed him out of my life, right? Because I couldn't drink and drug and do the things I was doing and treat people the way I was treating them and live by the morals that I had learned in Sunday school. I couldn't, right? I had to push one out. Jumped right into the fourth step. My sponsor made it easier on me. I was probably 4 or 5 months sober when he started me writing my four step. Now, dummy me dragged my feet at it, and you know, I would see him every Tuesday night at my home group, and he'd say, Ross, how's that four step coming? And I'd say, it's coming along great, Bob. And I hadn't touched it all week, honestly, and so I would feel guilty, and so I'd go home after the meeting. And I'd drag it out from under the bed, and I'd start writing until I was just so emotionally, spiritually, mentally twisted up, I couldn't stand it, and I'd throw it back under the bed. And I wouldn't touch it again until I saw Bob, and Bob says, how's that four-step going? But he guided me, and it took me, I was about 2 weeks shy of my one-year anniversary when I sat down and did my fifth step with my sponsor. And was able to just let go of all of the junk that I had piled inside of here. I think of this as my spiritual vessel today, right? And I had filled it full of so much junk that his job was to help me take it and shake it out and spread it out and sort it out. And we'll keep the good parts, but we're going to let go of the bad parts. And that's what I did in the fifth step. It doesn't change a single thing that I ever did in my whole life. It does not change one single thing. If a man is struggling with anything that I have experience with, I can pull down those memories and share them, right? If somebody's struggling with anger, rage, hitting, okay, well, I have some experience, okay? Infidelity and so on and so on. I have experience, right? But what it did do for me was it disconnected and alleviated all the emotions that were tied up around those experiences, right? I have no more shame over the things that I've done. I've let go. In fact, God removed from me all of the guilt that was inside of me over all of the things that I had done for all those years. Continue to move forward through my house cleaning, you know, step 6 and step 7. I have learned our lifetime steps, you know. Right out of my 4-step, I could say I was a thief, I was a liar, and so forth, right? But I haven't stolen anything, since I got sober. I have not intentionally taken something that didn't belong to me, or stolen a purse, or robbed somebody, or gone in somebody's medicine cabinet since I've been sober, right? I haven't done that. But I found myself, 30 years later, taken an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and 30 minutes for a lunch break. Well, guess what? Here comes that character defect back again. And I'm stealing time from my boss, right? And so as soon as I recognized that, right, I had to go straight back to 6 and 7 and name it what it is. I was stealing. I was a thief. I am a thief, right? And that I will not do this any longer, right? I can modify my behavior. If I take a 90-minute lunch break, I stay in the office till 5:30. Easy. My boss is happy with that. He didn't care what time I got in, what time I left, right? But I owed them 40 hours a week. Right? So 6 and 7 is a lifetime set of steps that is something I have to pay attention to always. Although I ask God to remove my character defects, right, and I stop the gross behaviors that I was doing when I was out running, right, they keep coming back up, little by little, piece by piece. 8 and 9, again, back to the 4-step, and here's the list of people that I need to make amends to, right, and the things that I did, right, and so, you know, jumped right into that. My sponsor helped me. We did some practice stuff, right? We would, he'd say, you know, you make amends to me for this or that, right? And he'd pull out my brother-in-law or my sister or my, you know, co-worker and help me a lot. Step 10, 11, and 12, those are what I consider the maintenance steps. Those are the ones that I pay attention to on a daily basis to keep me on the straight and narrow. Right, to take care of my spiritual self, just like I talked about very early in that passage of hope out of the big book. You know, 10, that's easy. At the end of my day, what have I done? Where have I been selfish? Where have I mistreated others? Where have I taken advantage of somebody else? And if I can say I didn't today, well, what a glorious day that is, right? The next morning when I wake up, start with a reading, either the big book or one of the daily meditations, and just kind of set the frame of the day. God, if it's your will, right, give me the strength and the guidance so I can not just not drink today, but I can be of service to you and other people, right? Help me be something of use into society, into this world, right? You know, and that's easy. It's easy because I practice a lot. Somebody said it at my book study the other day. Finding my spiritual faith was like finding a muscle I didn't know I had, right? It's a new muscle inside of me, right? And like any muscle, if I work it and practice at it, it gets bigger and stronger and becomes, you know, but if I don't, it atrophies and falls apart, and very soon I'm standing there saying, what happened? Well, it's because I didn't do anything. I didn't do any of the work. Today I'm blessed to have a treatment center very close to me. So I get to go by there on a regular basis, and those men are hungry. I mean, they're hungry for Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're hungry for recovery. So I have sponsored 300 or 400 men over the last 5 or 6 years, and not every man makes it. We know that, right? We know that. But so many do, and it's wonderful. You know, I'll get a text or a picture of a chip or a picture of a family and say, Ross, got my 3-year chip today. Me and the kids are so grateful, right? And, oh, man, so giving it away to keep it, right? Every new sponsee that I work with, every single one of them, forces me to go back to this book and work the steps again. And how wonderful is that? I mean, it's like, you know, now many of these men are from all over the country. And so after 30 days, 90 days, 180 days, depending on how long they're in Williamsburg, they go back to wherever home may be, right? But I can stay with them, at least on the phone, until they find a home group, until they find a home sponsor, until they get that eyeball contact that's so important, and then make sure there's a good handoff. And what a blessing that is, right? And for me to give 2 or 3 hours a day to recovery, to God, to my fellow human beings, compared to the 3, 6, 9 hours a day that I was given to running and alcohol and chasing, yeah, life is wonderful. There's no aspect in my life today that doesn't tie directly back to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? My kids were just about done with me, right? Today, they allow me to be around them, around my grandkids, 7 grandkids, and not a one of them has ever seen me take a drink. And that is absolutely a blessing from God, right? I retired about 6 months ago at the age of 60, right? I was able to toss in the papers after a 40-year career with the same company. And so I don't have to work today. You know, it opens up the door to do things just like this. You know, when Billy says, could you? And it's like, absolutely, you know, for what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, for me to be able to give back just a little dribble, just a little dot, you know, wife, family, kids, grandkids. There is no aspect in my life, no aspect in my life that is not vastly improved because I put the plug in the jug. I worked the 12 steps. I continue to work the 12 steps, and I continue to have faith and gratitude, you know, from God. And with that, I want to thank you guys. I hope I didn't bore you to death. And amen. Yeah.